Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really focused look, a deep plunge, you could say, into the rules for finding success, focused success, in what's become, well, probably the most distracted economy ever. We've gathered a stack of sources, all looking closely at cognitive performance, and our mission really is to figure out how to cut through the noise and get back our most valuable thing, our attention. Okay, so let's start unpacking this. The whole discussion seems to pivot on one key difference: deep work versus something else. Deep work sounds, well, intense. How do we know if what we did today actually counts as deep work?
That's a great question. It really comes down to the core definition. Deep work is basically any activity that's cognitively demanding, right? Mm-hmm. And it has to be done without distractions, in a state of real concentration.
Right.
The key is that it pushes your abilities, like, right to their limit. And maybe most importantly, creates new value, something genuinely hard for someone else to just replicate quickly. Think of it as, you know, creating high-value intellectual property or maybe a unique insight.
Okay, pushing limits, creating new, hard-to-copy value. Got it. So what's the opposite then?
That's what we call shallow work. Mm. These are the tasks that don't really demand much brain power. Logistical stuff, often done while you're distracted, maybe listening to music or half listening to a call. Things like, you know, scheduling meetings, answering really routine emails, filling out forms. Your brain isn't sweating. It's easy for anyone to do, easy to replicate, and it doesn't create much, if any, new value in the world.
Right. And this is where it gets really critical, doesn't it? Because it feels like most of us in our day-to-day are sliding much more towards that shallow end.
Precisely. Yeah. That's the core problem.
Yeah.
Because all these network tools are everywhere. Email, Slack, social media feeds, the constant notifications. Most knowledge workers today are, frankly, losing the ability to sustain deep, concentrated effort. There was a McKinsey study, I think, back in 2012 that had some pretty chilling numbers. It found the average knowledge worker spends something like over 60% of their week just doing electronic communication and searching online.
60%.
Wow. Yeah. And almost 30% of their total time was just on email. Just email.
That's incredible.
It means our attention is constantly being chopped up into these tiny, tiny pieces. Real concentration starts to feel like some kind of, I don't know, old-fashioned habit we've lost.
Okay, so if we're spending most of our time on these easy-to-replicate, shallow tasks, why should we even bother fighting this trend? Why is deep work so valuable, economically speaking, right now?
Well, there are two main reasons, really. First, it's about rapid learning. The economy today runs on complex systems that change incredibly fast. Think new AI tools, new programming languages, shifts in digital marketing platforms. To stay relevant, to stay valuable professionally, you absolutely have to be able to master complicated things quickly. And that kind of deep mastery doesn't happen from just skimming articles or attending a quick webinar. It needs intense, uninterrupted focus to literally rewire your brain.
Okay, so learning fast is one. What's the second?
The second is enabling elite production. Look, we're in a global information economy now. If you're a writer, a coder, a strategist, whatever, your potential clients or audience can access the best talent anywhere in the world instantly. So to really succeed, you can't just be okay. You have to produce the absolute best stuff you're capable of producing. If your output is just mediocre or easily replicable by someone else, or maybe even an AI soon, the market's just going to ignore it. It's why the business writer Eric Barker called deep work the superpower of the 21st century. I think that sums it up pretty well.
A trainable superpower. I like the sound of that. But it does sound a bit extreme. This idea that locking yourself away somehow translates directly into market value. Is there solid proof? Real examples?
Oh, absolutely. History is full of people who figured this out, maybe instinctively. Take Carl Jung. You know, he was in this intense rivalry with Freud, trying to establish his own school of analytical psychology.
Yeah.
So in 1922, he built this place called the Bullingen Tower, a sort of stone retreat by Lake Zurich. It was incredibly basic, no electricity, just oil lamps, a fireplace. But crucially, he had a private office there that he could lock.
Why lock it? Just for peace and quiet.
Not just that. He built it specifically, he said, to guarantee himself 2 hours of completely undistracted writing every single day. He knew he needed that deep focus to develop his complex theories and really compete with Freud. So for Jung, isolation wasn't an escape from work. It was the engine for his career.
That's a powerful example. Not escaping work, but advancing it through isolation.
Exactly. And then you have maybe more lighthearted examples.
Like
Mark Twain.
Fishing.
Yeah, he wrote a huge chunk of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer in this tiny little shed up at Quarry Farm.
Mm-hmm.
It was so far from the main house, so deliberately isolated, that his family actually had to blow a horn to call him for meals.
You can't get much clearer about wanting uninterrupted time than meeting a horn summons.
Totally. And it's not just historical figures. Look at Bill Gates today,
mm-hmm.
a symbol of modern tech productivity, right?
Sure.
He famously takes these think weeks twice a year, goes off completely alone to a remote cabin, no meetings, no calls, just reading papers, thinking, and generating strategy.
And didn't he write a pretty major memo during one of those?
He did. The famous 1995 Internet Tidal Wave memo came out of a think week. It dramatically shifted Microsoft's entire strategy towards the internet and basically set their course for the next decade or more.
Mm.
Isolation fueling major strategic shifts.
Okay, so these examples definitely show deep work is the high value stuff, which brings us right back to that that paradox you mentioned.
Exactly. The paradox is, if this kind of deep concentration is so clearly linked to elite success and value creation, why are so many modern business trends seemingly designed to destroy it?
Right, like open plan offices built for constant interruption, or this expectation that you have to reply to emails or Slack messages instantly.
Yeah, it feels like we're actively eroding the very capacity we need most.
So what's driving this? What are these systemic forces pushing us towards the shallow end, even when we know deep is better?
Well, the research points to about four main forces acting on us in the modern workplace. The first one is something called the metric black hole.
Metric black hole.
Yeah. It basically means it's really, really hard to objectively measure the individual contribution of a knowledge worker, especially when their work involves creativity, deep learning, complex problem solving, things that just don't fit neatly onto a timesheet or into a simple output metric. And because it's so hard to quantify the value of deep work or the cost of distraction, a lot of irrational workplace behaviors can kind of take root and flourish.
Okay, so if you can't measure the good stuff easily,
then you fall victim to the second force. The principle of least resistance. In the absence of clear feedback on what activities truly create value, people naturally drift towards doing what's easiest in the moment. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Implementing a really thoughtful, complex planning system, like David Allen's Getting Things Done, which takes serious effort to set up and maintain, that's hard work.
Definitely.
What's much, much easier, just running your day out of your inbox, constantly reacting to whatever pops up, feeling busy answering emails and messages. That immediate response feels productive, and it's the path of least resistance compared to deep, planned work.
So we take the easy path, which leads us straight back into shallowness, and that connects directly to the third force, right? This idea of busyness as a proxy for productivity.
Exactly. Since the actual output of deep work is hard to see and measure moment to moment, we start substituting visible activity for actual productivity.
So looking busy becomes the goal.
Pretty much. We use signals like sending emails at all hours, constantly being available on Slack, maybe working late visibly in the office, as proof that we're valuable employees, even if all that activity is shallow.
Is that like the Marissa Mayer example at Yahoo?
That's a classic illustration, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She famously banned remote work. And the justification wasn't necessarily about output. It was reportedly because she checked the VPN logs and was unhappy that remote employees weren't signing into the company servers often enough.
So not logging in enough meant not working hard enough, in her view.
The signal seemed to be, if I can't see you being busy, I'm going to assume you're not being productive. Which completely misunderstands how knowledge work, especially deep work that requires focus and thought, actually happens. It's often quiet internal work, not constant visible activity.
Okay, metric black hole, least resistance, busyness as proxy. What's the fourth force?
The fourth one is a bit more ideological. It's called the cult of the internet.
Cult of the internet.
Yeah, it's this sort of background belief system where anything associated with the internet or high tech is automatically assumed to be good, innovative, and necessary for any modern business, regardless of its actual impact on the core work.
Ah, so things like demanding everyone have a constant social media presence.
Exactly, or adopting open offices because they seem modern and collaborative,
yeah,
thanks to tech company trends, even if they destroy concentration. Or pressuring, say, serious investigative journalists to constantly interrupt their deep research to fire off tweets. Deep work, which is fundamentally about craftsmanship, quality, and sustained focus, often looks kind of old-fashioned compared to the shiny new thing, allure of constant connectivity and high-tech shallow activities. These are assumed to progress just because they use new tools.
Okay, those four forces paint a pretty bleak picture of why workplaces push us towards shallow.
They really do. And understanding why it's happening systemically is important. But then we need to look at the cognitive level, what actually happens in our brain when we give in to those shallow temptations. Why is just quickly checking email so bad for deep work?
Right, because it feels harmless, doesn't it? Just a quick glance.
It feels harmless, but cognitively it's devastating. The mechanism is called attention residue.
Attention residue. Okay, let's break that down. Why is that quick glance never really just a quick glance?
Exactly. So imagine you're working deeply on task A, maybe writing a complex report. Then you switch, even for 30 seconds, to task B, like checking an email notification that just popped up. When you switch back to task A, your brain doesn't make a clean break. A residue, like a cognitive echo of your attention, remains stuck thinking about task B, the email you just saw.
So part of your brain is still back in the inbox.
Pretty much, yeah. And this residue effect is much worse, much thicker, if the switch was really quick. Or, crucially, if task B was left unresolved. For example, you glance at your inbox and see a message about some brewing crisis on a project, but you can't actually deal with it right then. When you try to go back to writing your report, a significant chunk of your mental energy is still unconsciously chewing over that problem email. You're not fully present for the deep task.
Okay, that makes sense. You're physically back at the report, but mentally you're split.
Exactly. And that directly impacts the fundamental formula for quality work, which is essentially high-quality work produced equals the time spent working, multiplied by the intensity of your focus during that time.
Ah, so that quick glance, that unresolved EMIS check, it might not take much time, but it massively damages the intensity of focus when you return.
Precisely. Checking your inbox every 10 minutes might feel like you're staying on top of things, but the attention residue from each check drastically lowers the intensity you can bring back to your main task. It effectively sabotages the quality of your deep work, even if you put in the hours.
That's a huge realization. The constant switching is the problem. Okay, so if this state of fragmentation is so damaging, but also so common, is it reversible? Can we train ourselves back? I think most people listening probably feel like their ability to concentrate deeply has eroded.
Absolutely. The good news is that concentration is like a muscle. It can be weakened through disuse and distraction, but it can also be strengthened through deliberate practice. Deep work is a trainable skill.
Do you have an example of someone who really had to rebuild this from, say, near zero?
The perfect case study is a guy named Jason Benn. He was working as a financial consultant, doing a lot of manual data entry and manipulation in Excel. He had this dawning realization that his entire job could probably be automated by a fairly simple Excel macro. His skills were becoming obsolete. He knew he desperately needed to learn a new hard skill programming, which is a classic deep work task requiring intense, sustained focus.
Okay, so he needed deep work skills, but did he have them?
Not at all. By his own admission, he was massively struggling with distraction. He confessed that sometimes he'd waste like 98% of his workday just surfing the web and clicking around. He had basically lost the capacity to focus.
Wow, 98%. That's relatable for many, probably, but extreme. So what did he do? How do you break a cycle like that? His solution sounds pretty radical.
It was definitely drastic, but maybe necessary given how deep the distraction habit was. To force himself to concentrate, he literally, in his words, locked myself in a room with no computer, just textbooks, note cards, and a highlighter.
No computer at all?
None. For 2 solid months. Just him, the physical learning materials, and 0 digital distractions. This intense, forced isolation period essentially retrained his concentration muscle. He managed to clock 5 or more hours of completely disconnected, deep focus, studying programming concepts every day. And the result? He eventually graduated top of his class from a really difficult coding boot camp.
And the payoff?
Direct and significant. His salary immediately jumped from around $40,000 a year to $100,000 a year. It's a powerful testament. Deep work isn't some innate talent you either have or don't. It's a skill you can train, and the market rewards that skill heavily.
That's incredibly motivating. Okay, so if deep work is trainable, the next question is how? You can't just willpower your way through distractions all day, right? Our willpower is limited.
Exactly right. Just deciding to focus more usually fails because you burn through your willpower fighting off distractions. The key is developing specific routines and rituals around your deep work. These habits minimize the amount of willpower needed to transition into and stay in a state of concentration.
Routines and rituals. Okay. So the first step seems to be choosing a kind of overarching strategy or philosophy for how you'll integrate deep work into your life, one that fits your specific circumstances.
That's right. Cal Newport outlines 4 main philosophies he observed in successful deep workers. The first one is the most extreme. The monastic philosophy.
Monastic, like monks.
Pretty much. This involves structuring your life to eliminate or radically minimize almost all shallow obligations. You basically become a hermit for deep work. Think of someone like the famous computer scientist Donald Knuth. He famously doesn't use email at all, hasn't for decades.
No email? How does he function?
He has an assistant-managed postal mail.
Yeah.
Or consider the sci-fi author Neal Stephenson. He avoids email, social media, most forms of easy communication because, as he puts it, writing novels requires huge, contiguous chunks of time. Fragmented bits just destroy the process. This approach obviously requires immense control over your professional life.
Right, not feasible for most of us. What's the next option?
The second is the bimodal philosophy. This is less extreme. It involves dividing your time into clearly defined, extended stretches, dedicated purely to deep work, separated from other periods where you handle all the shallow stuff. These deep work chunks might be, say, 2-4 days long, or maybe even weeks or months where you're completely inaccessible, followed by periods where you're fully available.
Okay, so like blocks of time. Is that the approach Adam Grant uses, the Wharton professor?
Yes, he's a prime example. He famously stacks all his teaching duties, student meetings, and administrative tasks into the fall semester. This frees up his spring and summer for long, uninterrupted periods dedicated solely to deep research and writing.
That makes sense for an academic schedule, but again, like the monastic approach, it seems to require a lot of control over your schedule that many people in, say, typical corporate jobs just don't have. If you have daily meetings and constant demands, how do you go bimodal for 3 days?
That's the major limitation, you're right. Bimodal works best if you have that kind of seasonal or project-based control like academics, consultants, or maybe artists. For people with more standard daily obligations, the third philosophy is often more practical, the rhythmic philosophy.
Rhythmic, okay, what does that look like?
This is all about building a regular daily habit. You create a ritual where you do your deep work at the same time, in the same way, every single day. The consistency makes it automatic. It becomes part of your routine, like brushing your teeth. By making it a habit, you drastically reduce the willpower needed each day to decide when and how you're going to do your deep work. You just do it.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. There's a story of Brian Chappell, who was working on his PhD dissertation while holding down a full-time job and raising a young child. A very demanding schedule. His solution was rhythmic. He committed to working on his dissertation every single weekday morning from 5 a.m. to 7:30 a.m. before the rest of the house woke up, before the demands of the day kicked in. That consistent rhythm allowed him to make steady progress.
Okay, monastic, bimodal, rhythmic. That covers quite a few scenarios. Is there one more? What about people whose schedules are just inherently chaotic and unpredictable, like, say, journalists covering breaking news or executives juggling constant crises?
Yes. For those situations, there's the journalistic philosophy. This is probably the hardest to pull off effectively.
Why is that?
Because it involves fitting deep work into your schedule wherever you can find an unexpected pocket of time. You might have a meeting end early, giving you 45 minutes, or maybe a flight delay gives you 2 hours. The journalistic deep worker has trained themselves to rapidly switch into deep work mode whenever an opportunity arises, even for short bursts.
So like Walter Isaacson writing his books.
Exactly. He's known for being able to switch into writing mode almost instantly, whether it's for 20 minutes between meetings or an hour during a family vacation. Apparently, people sharing a summer house with him would just hear the typewriter start pounding away unexpectedly, then stop, and he'd rejoin the group completely relaxed.
That sounds like it requires incredible mental discipline. Being able to drop into deep focus on command without much warm-up and then switch back out without that attention residue sticking.
It does. It takes a lot of practice to minimize the switching costs and residue when your schedule is that fragmented. But it shows that even in highly demanding, unpredictable roles, finding chunks for deep work is possible if you cultivate that ability.
Okay, so we have these different philosophies, these strategies for carving out time, but connecting this all back to the bigger picture, it feels like the benefits of deep work go beyond just the economic rewards, the salary jumps like Jason Benz. There's something more fundamental, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. This isn't just about productivity metrics or climbing the career ladder. It ties directly into our psychological well-being and to what makes life feel meaningful. Think about Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's groundbreaking research on flow. One of his surprising findings was that people often report being happier and more fulfilled at work than during their leisure time, even though they might wish for more leisure.
That seems counterintuitive. Why would work make people happier than free time?
Because, as Csikszentmihalyi found, the best moments in our lives usually occur when our body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. Deep work, by its very nature, pushing your cognitive limits, tackling challenges, creating something valuable, is a prime generator of that flow state. It creates that sense of engagement, challenge, and progress that leads to deep satisfaction and a sense of meaning. Shallow work rarely, if ever, does that.
So cultivating deep work isn't just good for your career, it's potentially good for your soul, for lack of a better word.
I think that's a fair way to put it. There's a deep human need to be challenged and to create things of value. Shallow work leaves that need unmet.
Okay, so the choice really does seem to be ours. If you buy into this idea, if you believe in the value of depth, both for your career and for your own sense of fulfillment, then the fact that this skill is becoming rarer and rarer actually presents a huge opportunity.
Exactly. It's a massive personal advantage for anyone willing to put in the effort to cultivate this skill in a world increasingly optimized for distraction.
We've covered a lot: the value of depth, the forces pushing us towards shallow, the cognitive cost of switching, and different strategies for building deep work habits. But to leave everyone listening with something really concrete to chew on, there's a specific, quite ruthless strategy mentioned in the source material for forcing yourself to prioritize deep work. It's called fixed schedule productivity.
Ah, yes, that one's powerful.
It's not about working longer hours. Quite the opposite. It's about setting a hard, non-negotiable end time for your workday, let's say 5:30 p.m. every single day, and then you work backwards from that fixed deadline.
Forcing constraint.
Exactly. So here's the provocative thought to consider. If you actually committed to that, if you are ruthless about finishing your workday by 5:30 p.m. every day, no exceptions, which of the non-vital, shallow tasks and commitments currently filling your hours would you be absolutely forced to eliminate? And perhaps more importantly, what profound, high-value, deep work would suddenly find the space to emerge and fill that time you just protected? Think about that trade-off. What would you cut to make space for depth?